Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Beer, an alcoholic drink made from yeast fermented malt flavored with hops. That's right, you've tuned in to the Farm Report on the Heritage Radio Network. It's 1 o'clock and we are coming to you live from the back of Roberta's in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. And we are in studio today with Mary Izzet. Mary, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Erin.
So Mary is president of the New York City Homebrewers Guild, in addition to writing a column for Ale Street News that covers beer issues for New York City and the Long Island area. She also has an amazing blog that covers all things craft beer and beer related. You can find it at mylifeoncraft.com. And we have Mary in the studio today to kick off a series we're going to be doing called Growing Beer. We're going to spend the next couple episodes of the Farm Report exploring beer as an agricultural product. And I thought probably the best way for us to start tucking into this would be to sit down with someone who can really take us through the beer making process. And that's where Mary came in. So Mary, as I said in the beginning, if you look up the Webster Dictionary of beer, it's called, you know, it's defined as an alcoholic drink made from yeast fermented malt flavored with hops. So the basic ingredients of beer, so far as I can tell, are water, barley, hops, and then yeast. Is that right?
Yes.
So
it does not necessarily have to be barley, but some type of grain.
Mm-hmm. So I thought what we would do is start by kind of taking each of those ingredients and breaking down a little bit about where they're coming from and what gets done to them prior to the beer making process. So maybe with the easiest, looking at water. I mean, is there specific guidelines around water usage with regards to beer?
Yes and no. Where do I start with water? Water is interesting because it makes up the majority of beer and it's obviously very important, but I think it can be altered more than some of the other factors. I mean, there are certain styles that have come about because of the particular type of water in the area. For instance, dry Irish stouts evolved because of the water in that area. Same with like the Pilsners, right? They're very clear. They're brewed in an area that has very soft water, no hard minerals, no salts. So you can get a very light, crisp, you know, Pilsner or a lager. Here in Brooklyn, actually our water profile is very close to the Pilsen area. And we're very lucky as homebrewers and also brewers in the New York City area in that they can pretty much they're starting with pretty clean water. And if they want to add anything, any salt or anything, they can. So, but I mean, I'd say, you know, certain breweries might need to doctor their water, but it's not, I mean, our water is pretty clean these days.
In New York City. Yeah. We are lucky. We have that lovely Catskill, Delaware, Croton, absolutely, you know, yeah, reservoir system that we depend on. And I know that's something interesting that has come up a bit in the beer world over the last year or so is this issue of fracking. Mm-hmm. and breweries, a lot of breweries, I know in particular Omegang, where we were hanging out a couple of weeks ago, has taken a stance as a brewery that they are anti-fracking because as a business, water is one of their most vital resources. And so I think that's interesting and something we'll definitely touch on later in the series. Mm-hmm. But moving on to barley and hops. So can we talk a little bit between the two, you know, which is the bigger ingredient for beer?
I would say it depends on the style that you're brewing. They're both vital to making beer. I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about the brewing process or how? So basically, I mean, most beer is made with barley. You can also use wheat, rye. Some breweries are using small amounts of spelt. There's a lot of grains that are used in brewing, but those are the most common, I would say. So barley has to go through a process called malting. And basically what is done, traditionally there was floor malting. So barley was laid out on the floor. It was wet and then allowed to germinate slightly. And that's developing the starches inside each kernel. At the point where it's ready to be malted, which would depend on what the maltster or the brewery that's having the that's doing the malting wants. They would stop it at a certain time, drain the water, let it dry, and then kiln it. And then that's kind of how you determine what type of malt you end up with. So the temperature, the amount of air, how long it's kilned, it's basically baked in an oven. So just like, you know, you would bake, you might bake certain desserts more than others. And that would determine their texture and their, you know, their quality of taste. Same thing with malt. So you can have everything from like a pale malt, which is kilned for a very short amount of time at a lower temperature, perhaps, to a black patent, which is basically a little piece of crisp and is, you know, very black and kind of charred.
Okay, so it reminds me a little bit of coffee, like maybe coffee, like you have a light,
exactly.
coffee,
yes,
light roasted
yes.
coffee, a dark mm-hmm. roasted coffee. So,
and that's a great analogy. Yes,
the barley. I mean, is it just like if I go to the store and I buy a bag of barley for like barley soup? Does it look like? Is it that same grain, or is it?
Yeah, I think. Wow, I've never thought of that about that before. I think you can. I mean, I don't know. That would be. I don't know if you could malt your own barley after that, or if it's how the regular barley that we would use in cooking would is prepared.
Yeah, I wonder.
I know you can roast. I mean, as a home brewer, we can roast our own barley if we want to add, you know, kind of a special touch. Although nowadays, I mean, that's the amazing thing is both to commercial breweries in this country and home brewers, we have an amazing variety of malts available to us, probably more than at any time in the past.
And I think that's one of the interesting things about beer making in general is that at each, you know, it's on the onset seems like a very simple product, you know, a combination of, you know, 3-4 ingredients, but you can make a multitude of tiny decisions at any step in any of those processes that will have a completely different impact on the outcome. And so you mentioned kilning. Kilning is a fancy word for cooking in
yeah.
the oven,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, basically. Mm-hmm.
And I know one of the things we think about in agriculture a lot is not just kind of producing the actual grain for a product like this, but also what are the steps in between. So it sounds like for barley or whatever grain you were going to be using for beer making, that you would, one, need a farmer to grow it and mm-hmm. harvest it, but then there's this other step that has to happen.
Yeah, so there's usually actually a middle party called a maltster. There are some breweries that are large enough or, you know, usually European brewers that might have their own maltster within the brewery. Used to be more common than it is now, but now there's individual maltsters. And that is actually an interesting thing where farming comes about is that traditionally or recently there have only been, you know, large maltsters. So a lot of breweries in this country or homebrewers would get their barley might have been malted in Canada or Europe. And now smaller maltsters are coming back to this country. So I know there's at least one or two on the West Coast, and then we're very lucky to have Valley Malt now, which is in Hadley, Massachusetts. It's run by a couple, and they're a very small maltster. I think they're a little over a year old, maybe a year and a half old. And this is the first time we've been able to get locally malted product, as a home brewer at least. And I think there's some craft breweries in the region that are also using their malt. And it's really exciting to be able to buy, you know, malted barley that's not only been grown in the region, but also malted in the region. So,
and I'm hoping to actually have those books on a later
show. They're wonderful. So
as a home brewer, I mean, one of the other things I want to touch on while we have you here is kind of this difference. You know, there seems to be beer making at the home brewer level, beer making at a craft level, and then kind of larger
macro breweries.
Mm-hmm. So as a home brewer, when you're looking to purchase barley, now that there's this maltery, you can go directly to there. But before mm-hmm. then, do you just get on the internet and kind of?
Yeah, I mean, we're lucky to have homebrew stores in the city now. There's at least four main places that you can purchase homebrewing ingredients in New York City, 3 in Brooklyn and 1 in Manhattan. But yeah, before that, pretty much people ordered from the internet or had to go to Jersey or Connecticut or something. We're very lucky that we can get local ingredients now. And then I also belong to Valley Malt, kind of has their version of a CSA, where I join for a year, I get 2 50-pound sacks directly from them, and then some smaller packs in between. So that's kind of nice. And some of the local homebrew stores are carrying the local malt as well as malt from Canada and Europe. So.
And when you actually get the malt, like if I'm holding a handful of malt in my hand, what does it look like?
Similar to what you would buy in the grocery store.
Okay, so it looks like the actual grain.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay, so there's the grain that you're using To form kind of the base of the beer. And then mm-hmm. hops are more of a flavoring agent.
Well, they do three or four major things. One, they add balance to the beer. So they provide bittering compounds that balance out the malty sweetness of the beer. Two, they're a preservative, actually. And then three, they also provide a lot of aroma and flavor. So I'd say those are the three main reasons that we use hops in brewing.
And where do you, I mean, what's the story with hops? Can you just pick a hop off the hop vine? And
yes, you can. So it's interesting. So a couple things kind of to look at how we use hops as homebrewers or brewers. So when you're, one of the most important things is that pretty much every beer, regardless if it has a hop flavor or aroma character, still has to have that, you still want that bittering quality to some degree, or that balancing quality. And the way you do that is through these bittering compounds. And each, when you buy a hop commercially, whatever form that you buy it in, it has what's called an AA percentage. And that helps you calculate how much bitterness you get out of the hop. So you can grow hops in your backyard or on your family farm or whatever here, but unless you have an unless you send them into a lab and have them tested, you're not going to know what bittering properties that has. So a lot of, I know there's, I have some friends that have been growing hops on Staten Island and also in their backyards in Brooklyn, and they generally use those hops as either flavoring and or aroma additions, and they might use a commercial hop as a bittering hop.
Okay.
Now, as we see more and more small hop farmers in the region, I know that there is a regional association, and there I've met some people that are starting hop farms up, and it takes a few years to establish, and for them in order to produce hops, those will then send the hops in and have them assayed. So
yeah, no, it was funny. I was just out at the Rockaway Beach last week mm-hmm. and ran into some folks who, like, apparently the Rockaway area is kind of perfect climate for hop production, and the Rockaway Brewery is looking at producing some of their own hops to kind of create a more like Rockaway localized
beer.
Now hops, there's a big freshness component to them. I mean, as far as like between when they're picked and when you use them, most hops for beer use are often pelletized. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And what is that? Like, what does that
mean? So basically hops, and I've never actually seen a hop processing plant or an area. But I recently attended a lecture that talked about how important it is, the processing of hops, and it's actually a pretty precise process. But basically the hops are picked and then they're dried, and then they could be processed further. So you can buy whole hops, which are dried. You can also buy leaf hops, which have kind of been chopped up, and then pellets. So basically they've been dried and then crumbled up and repackaged into pellets. They kind of look like rabbit food.
Okay.
Rabbit pelletized rabbit food.
And is there like a quality distinction? I mean, is it like tea where you get like the whole leaf tea and it's like more elegant or fancy? Than like the kind of ground Lipton bag
yeah.
of tea?
I think it depends. Personally, I don't think so, but I think I'm a pellet fan for my homebrew, but I think it depends who you talk to. There's other forms of hops that maybe macro breweries, like you can buy hop oils, you can buy a hop extract, that kind of thing. But that typically that's not used by craft or homebrewers. I mean, I think people like to use different forms of hops for different things. I have a lot of friends that dry hop maybe with whole hops or leaf hops. I find pellets just more, I don't make very many hoppy beers personally, but I find hop pellets a lot easier to use. There's in the actual brewing process, there's pros and cons to all of them. Hop pellets you have to use less, that they're, you know, since they're more compact and more concentrated, but they also produce kind of a sludge. It just depends. Everyone has their preferences, I think.
Harkening back to what we said earlier about each step being fraught with a million different outcomes. So
a lot of choices.
And then kind of finally, yeast. I know yeast is a big deal in the beer world, and often particular kind of strains of yeast are specific to specific beers or mm-hmm. specific regions. So can you talk a little bit about what are some of kind of the biggest groups of yeast and how we kind of, how you would purchase it or how you think about the characteristics that different yeast would impart to a beer?
So I think when you're choosing a yeast, you're basically going by the style of your beer. And certain yeasts are typical of certain styles of beer. I mean, you can go outside the box. It depends, you know, again, when you're building whether you're a home brewer or a craft brewer, when you're building a new recipe, you have to look at, you know, what flavors you want, what aromas, what characteristics. And definitely yeast can contribute a lot of those. The two main types of yeast are ale and lager yeast. And they're related, but they're basically fermented at different temperatures. So lager yeast generally ferment at a cooler temperature. Ales ferment at a higher temperature. Lagers, because they're fermenting at lower temperatures, they're not as expressive in flavor compounds like phenols or esters. So kind of fruity flavors or spicy flavors. So they generally will give you a cleaner flavor profile and not contribute as much flavor as, say, a ale yeast. And there's a whole spectrum, you know, between. There's also hybrid yeasts that have evolved. And then there's wild yeast and bacteria, which can also be used.
And so that's like something, if you were going to the homebrewer store, you could make a selection. Do you get what, like a little, I mean, does it look like baking yeast or?
Yes, it can. Typically there's dry yeast and wet yeast. A lot of homebrewers, and the two main wet yeast companies in this country, also provide a lot of yeast to commercial brewers there, and winemakers. So dry yeast looks like the little, you know, just like a packet of baking yeast, basically. And then wet yeast is in a solution. They're either come in tubes or these, what's called a smack pack, that has a little pack of yeast nutrient.
Nice.
So
you mentioned a couple of fancy words a minute ago. and I just want to talk about, you know, often when you are professionally preparing a food product, you have a language built around it that is different than kind of the man on the street would describe things. So maybe, right, can you tell us like the technical way for talking about the bitter, floral, or other components of a beer, and then how that translates into normal speak?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the terms that we use in talking about, you know, when you're designing your beer, what flavors and aromas that you want, and then also when you're drinking beer and tasting beer, are similar. Like, you know, bittering is definitely a word that's used. There are certain compounds, so esters and phenols are probably the top two words that we talk about. And those are typically compounds that are produced by yeast. They can also be produced by other ways in the beer. But generally when you're talking, esters is kind of a catch all, or it's represented by a fruity flavor. And that can vary from like a fresh pear flavor, apricot. You could have some darker fruit flavors. Phenols are typically expressed as a spice. So it could be like a clove flavor and a hefeweizen or some other spice. But those are usually both produced. So where you'll see those a lot, like a typical, like a hefeweizen will typically have more phenols in it. And then also esters. Ales generally produce more esters or more fruity flavors. Like next time, you know, if you're drinking a pale ale, you might not say, oh, this tastes like, you know, has a fruity quality. But if you drink it side by side with a lager, you will notice that there's more of a fruit flavor.
Interesting. So I think we are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will start walking our way through the actual brewing process. So stay tuned.
Went to the preacher, said I'm a man of sin. Still didn't mean the fear of God, but all he was man enough. Going down. Yeah, I'm going down. Yeah, I did it then. Lord knows I'd do it again. I'm going down. So I went to my sister, saw what he had done. Left with us, you know.
All of us at Cane Vineyard and Winery are proud to support Heritage Radio Network and the growing movement to change the way we eat and think about our planet. For more information, go to cane5.com.
I know he may roam.
All right, we are back. You're tuned into the Farm Report on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks, and we are in studio with Mary Isett, president of the New York City Homebrewers Guild, and we are tucking into the first in our series of growing beer. So, Mary, we talked a lot about the basic ingredients and some of the processing techniques or choices that you make when you're about to brew, but now let's tuck into the actual brewing process. So, can you walk us through it, you know, from a home brewer's perspective? If I'm going to kind of hop into my kitchen and make my first batch of beer, where do I start? And as you go through it, just kind of highlight some of the equipment that's particular to beer making.
Okay. I'll take it through a traditional style. I do a modified style that's more suited to an urban kitchen. But basically, in the same way that we homebrew, is the same way that craft brewers brew as well, that larger brewers brew as well. So you're going to start with, you need to mash your grain. And basically what that means is that you're going to heat water. Usually you use a ratio depending on your equipment and what you want. But basically you're making kind of an oatmeal or a porridge, or even you can compare it to a tea, where you're mashing at a certain temperature, or a certain temperature range. And what that does is it activates enzymes, that will convert the starches in this barley that's been malted into sugars. So you basically, what you want to get ultimately from the mashing process is a high sugar water. So you generally mash for a certain amount of time. 60 minutes might be a good average. At that point, you're going to drain off the water, the sugar water. It's also called liquor at this point. And you're going to do something called sparge. Sparging is somewhat optional, but typically in the all-grain brewing process, you sparge. And that's basically just rinsing your grains. It's just like you might do with a tea. If you have a very special tea that you want to use twice, you might reuse the tea bag and get... you know, basically get more tea out
like
of it
a for second a second infusion.
Running. Yeah.
Got it.
So basically you've drained that sugar water, and now you're getting as much of your sugar that, you know, the remaining sugar that might be in that grain as you want. So you're basically just rinsing it with an additional warm water at a certain temperature. Then after that's done, you have this vat of sugar water, you're going to go into the boil stage.
So you have, you know, your big pot with grain and water, and you've cooked it for a certain period of time, and then you strain it,
mm-hmm.
and the actual porridge barley matter is garbage at that point, or, you know, recycling.
It's, yeah, it's spent
or
grain. Yeah,
spent grain.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you're basically left with, you know, this drained pile of matter. Also, one important thing is that the barley has to be crushed. Your grain has to be crushed. So you would do that before the mash. We didn't talk about that, but so
how would you crush it?
Most commercial breweries have their own crush, you know, their own mill. I have a home brewing mill at home, but then if you're a home brewer, the home brewing stores have their own mill, so they'll mill your grain for you.
Okay, and is that like grinding coffee, basically?
Yeah,
okay,
similar to that.
All right,
and you can set, you know, for finer, depending on what kind of grind you want, you would set your mill like that, you know, to the fine or coarse or whatever. So anyway, after the mash and you've strained and then also rinsed your grain, you end up with a wort. And basically you're going to boil that. And boiling this sugar water does a couple of things. It helps sanitize it. It can also cause changes. So you could have caramelization of that sugar water. And then you also, importantly, get the bittering compounds out of your hops. So you would add your hops. You can do those at various times.
Is the wort is just the sugar, the, mm-hmm. another word, the beer word for sugar water.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And is it wort before and after you put hops in it? Like, it's wort through this whole
kind
of stage?
Yeah, through the whole boiling.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I know they call it liquor, I think, right when it comes out of the mash. And I'm not sure at what stage it's actually, you can call it wort, but wort's a good catch-all term from basically the time that you extract it from your mash to the time that you add it to your pitch the yeast. So the wort, and hops, the bittering compounds in hops take a time to work. Or you can, depending on how much bittering you want, will depend on how much time you boil. So you would basically add your hops like 16 minutes in or 90 minutes in order to get the bittering compounds. And towards the end, you might add hops to get flavor and aroma. So you might add flavor hops 15 minutes before your end of your boil. Aroma, you know, 10 minutes, 5 minutes, or at the end of the boil. But basically, typically, you would want to boil for at least 45 minutes to 60 minutes. You can boil for up to 3-4 hours if you're making a specialty beer that you want caramelized or other things to happen. You're boiling for a number of other reasons, too, that will improve the quality of the beer and increase head retention and ability to produce a head and make it clear. All these things are also determined by the boil, but generally the main thing about the boil, you want to sanitize, get your hop bittering,
and the head is like the foam on,
yeah,
the beer.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, at this point, and one of the things that's so striking to me about the beer making process is sound. I mean, it's so identical to, you know, cooking. If you're really trying to make a very fine, you know, chicken stock, you want to control the temperature and the time, and you add your aromatics at different points to kind of create different like depths or levels of flavor. And so beer is very similarly like you're kind of building a flavor and a structure to the actual product.
Anyway, at the end of your boil, commercial brewers generally whirlpool, and basically you're just spinning you have to cool you want to cool pretty quickly, chill this beer pretty quickly. You might want to do a whirlpool, which would basically amass some of the hot matter and everything in the bottom and kind of some of the proteins and stuff. And then you're just going to rack off to some type, whatever you're fermenting in, whether it be a conical fermentation container, in a home, you know, professional brewery or some kind of carboy, a water, like a 5 gallon water container, for a home brewer. After it's cooled down, you know, then you would rack to this container and then pitch your yeast.
Okay. So racking is basically putting it into another container.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And that's just what we use for whenever you move the beer from one container to another. That's just the term that we all use.
Okay.
Is racking, at least on a homebrewer level.
So you have in your new container now this cooked off liquid that's cooled to like room temperature, or
it depends on what the beer that you're making. I mean, I usually try to get mine, if I'm making a typical yield, I try to get it between 60 to 70 degrees.
Okay. And then it's at this point that the yeast comes into play.
Yeah, so you toss your yeast in, or we call it pitching our yeast, and then we would secure it with an airlock, something that keeps out the air, allows the carbon dioxide that's going to be produced by the yeast out, but no air in. Same thing with the wine. And then you ferment it, and you want pretty tight temperature control if you can, but you ferment it at a temperature that's predicted by the type of yeast and then how you want that yeast to be expressed. And then you'll have beer.
So I have, you know, I'm in my apartment and I have my container of beer with the yeast, and it's sealed. It has to be some kind of special container. I can't just put it in a glass bottle with a screw top. I mean, is there like a...
Well, you want an airlock, basically. Okay. Something that, you know, that will allow the CO2 out, but not... No outside air in.
Because you don't want to have like a buildup of CO2.
Yeah.
That's where you hear like... You know, I've heard stories of like beer bottles.
Yeah.
I've been in kitchens where my chef has been experimenting with fermentation and I've gotten winged by exploding bottles.
And you don't want contamination from the outside air, because outside air does contain a lot of yeast and bacteria.
So the fermentation process, what's the length of time we're talking about?
It can vary drastically. It could be anywhere from, I'd say, 4 days to years.
Wow. Okay.
Years for very specialty beers.
So that's uncommon. So this whole time, you know, you're essentially, at least initially, following a recipe.
Mm-hmm.
Recipe that tells you what's the water to grain ratio, what's the hop ratio, what time you add the hops, how much yeast, how much time to let it sit. As kind of a benchmark, I'm sure if you're a more experienced brewer or home brewer, that like an experienced cook, you can kind of build on instinct at some point. But so how do you know like when the beer is done? I mean, you just kind of have your best guess based on the factors that you have knowledge of?
You would typically use something called a hydrometer. And professional brewers as well as home brewers use this. It's basically, so actually before you pitch your yeast, you would take a hydrometer reading. And you're basically measuring gravity or the concentration of sugar in that water, in that solution. And then after your beer's done, it's going to, so basically if you were able to take home or hydrometer meetings every day, you would see that the gravity would be dropping as the sugar is converted to carbon dioxide and alcohol by the yeast. So, you know, there's that sugar solution is becoming less concentrated. And then once you're done as a home brewer, you would take, I mean, it depends. As a beginner home brewer, I would take, you know, after 3 days of taking hydrometer meetings and they were all the same, then I knew my beer would be done. As you get experience and you get a little more handle on, you know, how that length of time, but same thing with commercial brewers, that they take gravity as well.
Okay. So then you get to enjoy the beer.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Whether you bottle it or keg it.
Okay. So you have kind of your container that you've fermented it in, and then you would rack it again, right? Into a new container.
Right. And so if you're kegging, you might just rack it directly into a keg and force carbonate it with carbon dioxide. The other option is to bottle it. Now, if you're a home brewer, you pretty much only have one option when you're bottling. A commercial brewery, it's not true. So a commercial brewer, if they bottle, they might actually filter that beer. So they filter the remaining yeast and anything else. And then they also might pasteurize. Now, very few craft breweries actually pasteurize, but a lot of them do filter. It does make it can the product can last longer. And they might actually force carbonate bottles in their brewery. As a home brewer, you have to bottle condition. And there are breweries that bottle condition as well, like Brooklyn Breweries Local 1 and Local 2 are both bottle conditioned. And that gives another aspect to the beer. I think it gives a liveliness that's typical of that style. But basically, if you're a home brewer or like Brooklyn Brewery, they might, if you want a bottle condition, you might add more yeast. But generally, as a home brewer, you have enough yeast still left in solution. So you would add some priming sugar to your beer to your beer at this point, and then bottle it. And so then over a period of maybe 2 weeks, that yeast would be reawakened, the yeast that's already in the beer solution, would be reawakened by the priming sugar and would convert that sugar to carbon dioxide, and you would get this natural carbonation in your bottle.
That was happening in the bottle. So, yeah. Wow. So I'm a little bummed because we're out of time, and I'm excited, however, to kind of continue this exploration of beer and growing beer over the next couple of weeks. We'll have people in to talk about the resurgence of hops and barley production in the Northeast, the malting and some of the infrastructure, as well as some interesting legislation that's happening around beer right now. If you were piqued by Mary's talk and want to learn more about the New York City Home Brewers Guild, you guys meet the third Tuesday of every month. I think your next meeting is September 18th.
Mm-hmm.
Membership's $25. What a deal. That's for the whole year. You get a t-shirt, and then you get 5% off at
Brooklyn Homebrew, Bitter and Esters, and Brooklyn Kitchen.
Awesome.
Off Homebrewing Supplies.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Mary. And thanks to Joe for engineering today's show. Like always, all of our shows are available through our website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. They're also available as a download from iTunes or on Stitcher Smart Radio. Come visit us September 9th. We are having a party in the back garden of Roberta's. It's our first annual fundraising party. Tickets are $150. We got some great chefs like Mike Anthony of Gramercy Tavern, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and a bunch of others, in addition to cocktails by our very own Dave Arnold. So you can find out more on that event and buy tickets at heritageradionetwork.eventbrite.com. Tune in next week at 1 o'clock to talk more about beer on another episode of the Farm Report. Thanks for listening.
What's hot at the green market? You're about to find out now. It's the Grow NYC Market Update.
Welcome to the Grow NYC Market Update. Green Market is a program of Grow NYC. It's the nation's largest and most diverse outdoor urban farmers market. Now, with 54 markets, over 230 family farms and fishermen participating, and over 30,000 acres of farmland protected from development. We are on the line with Jean Hodesh, who's going to give us the update. Jean, what is hot at the market now?
Hi, Erin. So what's going on at the market right now? Well, we are in harvest season, so you can find pretty much everything. But the things that are reaching kind of the end of their season, peaches, nectarines, cantaloupe, watermelon, my advice is to go out, buy it, and eat it now while you can, because those products aren't going to be around for too much longer. But there are some always exciting new products that are catching our eyes, so look out for artichokes. This week I ate some really amazing lima beans, and then apples are making their way into the market. So I've seen a whole bunch of different varieties that were just picked, first picking of the season, like Gallas, Ginger Golds, Opalescence, Red Delicious, and then some tart apples like Gravestein, Summer Pippins, and Paula Reds. And then right next to the apples, you're going to find the first pears, like Speckle Pears, Bartlett, and Red Bartlett's. And then I think, you know, it's the end of the summer. Things to look out for, make sure you don't miss some squash blossoms. If you haven't had any yet this season, now's the time to get those. Melissa Clark just did a huge spread in the New York Times on what to do with squash blossoms. I just made some in a squash blossom quesadilla for dinner the other night and picked up some other ingredients from the same stand to make a really amazing salsa to go with it. And then looking ahead just a little bit, you've seen a couple of grapes coming into the market already, but in just about another week, Buzzard Crest is going to be returning to Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn Borough Hall on Saturdays, and they have an amazing array of grapes from upstate. They also sell grape juice and wine, and you can pick up grapes, make grape jelly, or just eat them right when you buy them at the market. And then the last thing I wanted to tell you about was I was stopping by Cheryl Rogalski's stand in Union Square yesterday, and she had a small collection of pods that had dried black beans inside of them. She said, you know, we've been growing black beans on the farm for years, but last year in the hurricane, her entire crop got wiped out. And luckily, there were two chefs that she'd just sold 5-pound bags to before the crop got wiped out. And so they gave her back those beans, and she was able to replant them. And so this year, she's got beans at the market again. So those will be, she just had a few on display, but those will be coming into the market shortly.
Oh, that sounds awesome. Any upcoming events you want to share with us?
Yeah, so coming up in September, every year we help NOFA New York promote their Locavore Challenge. So the challenge is to eat within 250 miles every day for the whole month of September. And if you go to NOFA's website, they have a 30-day challenge. So there's a different challenge every day. So all kinds of different fun things you can do in addition to just preparing local food, like downloading an app that helps you figure out how to eat seasonally, or eating at a restaurant that sources their ingredients from local farms, or even starting to compost. And then coming up in our own market on September 8th, we're having the Green Market Youth Ed Sandwich Smackdown in the Union Square Parkhouse. And on September 9th in the East Village at our Tompkins Square Green Market, we're having Green Market Iron Chef. So Veselka and Hearth are going to go head-to-head to vie for the title of champion. So all of our events can be found on our website.
Awesome. That sounds great. So definitely do not miss those interesting black beans from Cheryl Rogalski's stand. Stay tuned for grapes. Get your last squash blossoms. If you want to learn more about the farmers, the market, or volunteer opportunities, as always, you can check out their website, www.grownyc.org, or follow them at Twitter at GAP Green Market or at UNSQ Green Market. And that has been another market report.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.